University of Hawaii, a Dr. Sumi Yamazaki, whose parents were also from Hiroshima. Dr. Yamazaki was a brilliant girl who was conducting 300 interviews with Japanese girls married to GIs, and she got to Akemi late in her study when her findings had begun to crystallize. Akemi, hoping that her intended visitor might be a woman of sophisticated intelligence, had first dressed in her most modern Tokyo style, so that she looked almost as if she had come from Paris. But when she saw herself in the mirror, she said, "Today I want to be very Japanese." And she had changed into a languorous pale blue and white shantung kimono with silver zori, and when she met Dr. Yamazaki, she found that it was the attractive young sociologist who was dressed like a real modern, with bright eyes and quick intelligence to match. The two women liked each other immediately, and Dr. Yamazaki made a brief mental note that she would transcribe later. Akemi Sakagawa appeared in formal kimono, therefore probably very homesick. And after two exploratory questions, the sociologist was able to categorize her hostess with precision. "Your kimono has told me all about you, Mrs. Sakagawa," she joked, in excellent Japanese. "Call me Akemi, please." "These are your complaints," the clever young sociologist said. "In Tokyo, you were a modern fighting for women's rights. Here you find yourself in an ancient Japan that even your parents never knew. You find the local speech barbarous, the intellectual outlook bleak, and the aesthetic view of life non-existent." Dr. Yamazaki hesitated, then added, "You feel that if this is America, you had better go back to something better." Akemi-san gulped, for she had not yet formulated that bitter conclusion, though for some time she had suspected its inevitability. Now, through the soft speech of another, the frightening words had been spoken. "Do many feel as I do, Yamazaki-sensei?" "Would it help you to know?" the young woman asked. "Indeed it would," Akemi cried eagerly. "You understand that my figures are only tentative." Akemi laughed nervously and said, "It's so good to hear a person use a word like tentative." "I'm afraid you're bitter," Dr. Yamazaki said reprovingly. "Any more than the others?" Akemi asked. "No." "I think you reached me just at the right time," Akemi said eagerly. "The general pattern is this," Dr. Yamazaki said. But before she could continue, Akemi interrupted and asked, "Would you think me a very silly girl, Yamazaki-sensei, if I said that I wanted to serve you tea? I am most terribly homesick." The two women sat in silence as Akemi prepared tea in the ceremonial manner, and when the ritual was ended, Dr. Yamazaki continued. "Suppose that 100 local soldiers married Japanese girls. 60 of the husbands were Japanese, 30 were Caucasians, 10 were Chinese. How have the marriages worked out?" Akemi-san asked. "Well, if you take the 30 lucky girls who married Caucasians, about 28 of them are quite happy. Some of the girls say they're deliriously happy. They say they wouldn't go back to Japan even if I gave them all at Hibaya Park." "They wouldn't go back to Japan?" Akemi gasped. "Were they girls who were interested in books or plays or music?" "Much like you. But you see, when a Haole man marries a Japanese girl, his parents are so shocked that they make a true spiritual effort to like the girl. And when they meet someone like you, gentle, well-bred, sweet to their son, they overcompensate. They love her more than is required. They make her life a heaven on earth." "Do such people listen to music?" Akemi asked. "Usually a Haole man hasn't the nerve to marry a Japanese girl unless he's rather sophisticated culturally. Such couples experience a very full spectrum." Akemi looked glumly at the bleak walls of the Sakagawa home, with a four-tube radio invariably tuned to a station that alternated American jazz with Japanese hillbilly songs. Whenever she and Goro went to a movie, it was invariably a Shanbara, a Japanese western in which the samurai hero fought 60 armed villains without suffering a wound. The Japanese girls who marry Chinese soldiers, Dr. Yamazaki continued, face a different problem. The Chinese parents are totally disgusted and convinced that there is no possibility of their liking the unseen daughter-in-law. So they spend the time till she arrives, hating her so much that when she finally gets here, they find she isn't anywhere near as bad as they had feared. When she demonstrates that she really loves their son, everyone reaches a plateau of mutual respect and things go reasonably well. But the Japanese marriages, Akemi asked, you won't dare say they go well. Some do, Dr. Yamazaki assured her. Where farm boys here have married farm girls from Hiroshima-ken, things work out rather well. But in a surprising number of cases, the Japanese-Japanese marriage does not do well. I think our figures are going to show that over 55% of such marriages have run into trouble. Why? Akemi pleaded. I was born in Hawaii myself, Dr. Yamazaki said. From the very kind of family you married into, stout Hiroshima peasants. And remember that even in modern Hiroshima, our Hawaii people would seem very old-fashioned. Anyhow, I'm partial to the local people. But the curious fact is this. The Caucasian mothers-in-law and the Chinese realize that they have to make a special effort to understand and love their strange new daughters. So they do so and find happiness. The stolid Japanese mothers-in-law, and God help the Japanese girl who marries my brother and who has to put up with my mother, well, it's obvious. They all think they're getting the kind of Japanese bride that used to flourish in southern Japan 40 years ago. They make no effort to understand, so they haven't the slightest chance of finding happiness with their new daughters. Do you know what's killing my marriage? Akemi asked bluntly. Dr. Yamazaki was not surprised at the forthrightness of the question, for she had watched the dissolution of several such marriages. But now Akemi paused, and it was apparent to Dr. Yamazaki that she was supposed to guess. So she volunteered, in Japan, young men are learning to accept new ways, but in Hawaii, they have learned nothing. Yes, Akemi confessed. Is that what the other girls say? They all say the same thing, Dr. Yamazaki assured her. But many of them outgrow their distaste, or somehow learn to modify their husbands. But do you know what will keep me from doing that? Akemi asked. What cuts me to the heart day after day? What? The sociologist asked professionally. The way they laugh at my correct speech. This I will not bear much longer. Dr. Yamazaki thought of her own family and smiled bitterly. I have the same problem, she laughed. I have a PhD degree. Then, imitating her mother, she asked, do you think you're better than we are using such language? So at home, in self-defense, I talk pidgin. I will not, Akemi said. I am an educated Japanese who has fought a long time for certain things. If you love your husband, Dr. Yamazaki said, you will learn to accommodate yourself. To certain things, never, Akemi said. Then she asked abruptly, have you ever been married, Yamazaki-sensei? I'm engaged, the sociologist replied. To a local boy? No, to a haole at the University of Chicago. I see. You wouldn't dare marry a local boy, would you? No, Dr. Yamazaki replied carefully. Akemi tapped the sociologist's notebook and laughed. Now I'm embalmed in there. One of many, Dr. Yamazaki said. But can you guess where I'd like to be? In a small coffee shop in the Nishiginza, surrounded by exciting conversation on books and politics and music. How could you guess so accurately? Akemi asked. Because I'd like to be there too, Dr. Yamazaki confessed. That's where I met my fiancé, so I know how lovely Japan can be. But I would say this too. Hawaii can be just as exciting. To be a young Japanese here is possibly one of the most exhilarating experiences in the world. But you said you wouldn't marry one of them, Akemi-san reminded her. As a woman, seeking happiness in a relaxed home, I'll stick with my Haole from Chicago. But as a pure intellect, if I were not involved as a woman, I would much prefer to remain in Hawaii. Tell me truthfully, Yamazaki-sensei, do you think that any society which has as its ideal a long black automobile can ever be a good place to live? Dr. Yamazaki considered the question for some moments and replied, You must understand that the visible symbols of success which our Japanese here in Hawaii are following are those laid down by the established Haole society. A big home, a powerful car, a boy going to Yale whether he learns anything or not. These are the symbols people living in Hawaii must accept. You can't suddenly require the Japanese to prove themselves superior to the symbols upon which they have been raised. For 3 years I've hoped my husband would, Akemi said bitterly. Be patient, Dr. Yamazaki pleaded, and you'll find Hawaii improving. I think not, Akemi said slowly. It's a barren, stupid place, and nothing will ever change it. The two young women parted, and that night Dr. Yamazaki called Shig Sakagawa, whom she had known at Punahou, and said, Shig, it's none of my business, but your brother Goro is going to lose his wife. You think so? I know so. She used every phrase the girls use before they catch the boat back to Japan. I've watched 19 of them go back so far. What could he do? Shig asked. Buy her 3 Beethoven symphonies, Dr. Yamazaki said, knowing that to blunt Goro such a step would be beyond the outer limits of imagination. Besides, Mrs. Sakagawa Sr. would never allow such music in her house. While the labor leader Goro Sakagawa faced these problems, or rather did not face them, Hawksworth Hale was concerned principally with the forthcoming marriage of his daughter Noelani to her cousin twice-removed Whipple Janders, the son of bold, straightforward Hula Janders, on whom Hawksworth had grown to depend so much in recent years. At one time, when Noelani was younger, Hawksworth had rather hoped that she might go outside the fort and find herself a completely new kind of husband. Somebody from Yale, of course, but perhaps an Easterner who had never seen Hawaii. For a while, when Noelani was a senior at Wellesley, she dated an Amherst boy, which was almost as good as Yale, but nothing had come of it. And when young Whip Janders, who was belatedly completing his Yale education, asked her to a spring dance at New Haven, each of them instinctively knew that they ought to marry. After all, they had known each other at Punahou. They were from families who understood each other. And Whip had been the closest friend of Noelani's brother, who had been killed over Tokyo. However, at one point in their engagement, Noelani had experienced haunting doubts as to the propriety of their marriage, for Whipple had returned from the war somewhat changed. He was thinner, and his fashionable crew cut did not entirely hide a tendency toward strongly individualistic behavior. Once at a Vassar dance, he had appeared in formal dress, but with a garish vest made of Hong Kong silk embroidered in purple dragons. He had been a sensation, but he had also been disturbing, for he had told one of the professor's wives, Thorstein Veblen would have loved this vest. And she had stammered, What? And he had given his imitation of a dying tubercular patient, adding, If you're going to have consumption, it ought to be conspicuous. It had been gruesomely funny, but unfortunately the professor's wife didn't catch on. Now Whip and his crew cut were back in Honolulu, dressed in Brooks Brothers' most austere fashion, and the wedding was about to take place. Shortly before the event, Noelani asked her father, for her mother was in one of her spells and could not comprehend questions, Do you think it's proper for kids like us to go on intermarrying, Dad? I mean, frankly, what are the chances that our children will be more like Mother than like you? In considerable embarrassment, for this was the nagging fear that had made him hope that Noelani would marry some Easterner, Hawksworth dodged the question and suggested, "Why don't we look into this with Aunt Lucinda? We always ask her about the family." "Which family?" Noelani asked. "The family. All of it," Hawksworth replied. And he drove his daughter up to see Aunt Lucinda in the mist-haunted house in Nuuanu Valley. When they arrived, they found that she was entertaining half a dozen ladies of nearly her own age, and most of them were drinking gin, so that the conversation wasn't exactly on focus, but there was a sweet, relaxed gentility about it. "This is my great-niece on my grandmother's side, Noelani Hale," Lucinda explained graciously, whisking her pale blue lace handkerchief toward the girl. "She's Malama Janders Hale's daughter, and on Saturday she's going to marry that fine young Whipple Janders, who is the great-grandson of Clement and Jerusha Hewlett." At once, Noelani's place in the great succession was established, and the women smiled at her admiringly, one saying, "I knew your husband's great-grandmother Jerusha very well, Noelani. She was a marvelous woman and could play polo better than the men. If young Whipple has her blood, he'll be a stalwart man, I can assure you." "What Noelani came to ask about," Aunt Lucinda explained, "is the extent to which she is related to Whip, and I would like to say right now that in my opinion it's a good deal safer to marry into a substantial island family whose bloodlines are known than into some purely speculative mainland family whose backgrounds could have originated God knows where." The women all agreed to this, and a Japanese maid in crisp white took their cups for more tea or their glasses for more gin. "The only possible question about the marriage of Noelani and Whip," Aunt Lucinda began, "is that each of them," and she lowered her voice, "does have a strain of Hawaiian blood. If you go back to her great-great-grandmother on her father's side, you find Malama Hawksworth, who was the daughter of Captain Reefer Hawksworth, who was not a missionary, but who was a most marvelous and courtly gentleman of the finest character and breeding. Of course, he married Noelani Kanakoa, the last Ali'i Nui. But I think it's safe to say that the Malama of whom we are speaking, the one that married the great Micah Hale, that is, well, anyway..." And with an airy gesture, she dismissed the whole matter. One of the most gratifying aspects of talking with Aunt Lucinda was that she threw out so many names that you didn't really have to listen. For when she found herself hopelessly involved in family lines, she stopped and started over again. Now, she switched abruptly and said, with no one able to guess how she arrived at the conclusion, "Anyway, no finer gentleman ever lived in Hawaii than Captain Reefer Hawksworth." The Japanese maid brought back the drinks, and Aunt Lucinda asked, "Where was I? Oh, yes. So from that unfortunate marriage of Micah to the half-caste girl Malama, you know, I often wondered where Micah got the courage to appear in public so much when he was saddled with such a marriage. Well, anyway, our little Noelani here does have that strain of Hawaiian blood, but it's more than overcome, I should think, by the Hale and Whipple strains. Except that the Whipple girl her great-grandfather married was not from what I like to call the uncontaminated Whipples, to which I belong, but from the branch that married into the Hewletts, which, as you know, were also half-castes, except for the first boy who married Lucy Hale, from whom I am descended." The mists from the Pali began to fill the valley, and a waterfall echoed mournfully as Aunt Lucinda continued her analysis of the family lines. Most of the meandering comments she made were meaningless to her listeners, but since all were descended from these early ancestors who had done so much to build Hawaii, each kept in the back of her mind some three or four specially prized progenitors to whom she attributed her character. And whenever Aunt Lucinda mentioned one of those names, that listener snapped to attention through the gin and nodded with special approval. Through the years, Lucinda had noticed that three names in particular evoked veneration. It was best to be descended from Jerusha Bromley Hale, the great missionary mother, or from Rafer Hawksworth, the courtly and gracious sea captain, or from Dr. John Whipple, the patrician intellect. Aunt Lucinda, with modesty, could point out that she was descended from two of the three. And in a way she was happy that she was not related to Captain Hawksworth, for of course all his offspring were part Hawaiian. "It's not that I'm against Hawaiians," she assured her visitors. "It's just that I get frightfully irritated at the hero worship that goes on around here over the so-called Hawaiian royalty. I sit in the library, and I can spot every Manihini girl who is going to ask me, 'Do you have that book on Kelly Kanakoa?' I have to stop myself from warning them, 'You'll have to put your chewing gum away while you look at the pictures.' And when she hands the book back reverently, she always says, 'Gee, his grandfather was a king,' as if that meant anything. I've always thought it was one of the most ridiculous aspects of Hawaiian life, the way they memorize these pathetic old lists of kings, as if a litany of imaginary names meant anything. You remember what Abner Hale, he was my great-grandfather, wrote about such ancestor worship? 'I think it impedes Hawaii as much as any other one thing, for the poor fools are so attentive to their past that they have no time to contemplate eternity.' And nothing makes me more irritated than the way a Hawaiian will point to some pathetic dregs of humanity and say, accusingly, 'If the missionaries hadn't interfered, he would now be our king,' as if we had halted something fine and good. Do you know who the present king of Hawaii would be if the missionaries hadn't put a stop to such nonsense? The beach boy, Kelly Kanakoa. Have you ever heard him speak? He insists on using a vocabulary of about 90 words, half of them blala. Everybody Kelly likes is blala, except that he calls me his sista." Hawksworth coughed, and his aunt collected her thoughts. "Oh yes, now about Whipple Janders. He went to Punahou and Yale, as you know, and had a very good record in the war. Handsome boy, but not so fleshy as his father, which is understandable, because Hewlett takes after the Hewlett side of the family, and they were always unprepossessing types, if you'll allow me to say so, Abigail, because, as you know, Abraham married a Hawaiian. Well, he picked up a Hawaiian Wahine after Urania died, but that's neither here nor there. I suppose what you're really interested in is how the intended bridegroom Whipple relates to the Hales. If you go back to Micah, who married the half-caste girl Malama Hawksworth, you'll remember that he had two children, Ezra and Mary. And Ezra, of course, was your great-grandfather, Noelani, and that takes care of that." The Japanese maid returned to pass coconut chips, toasted a delicious salty brown. "You may fill the glasses too, Kimiko," Aunt Lucinda reminded her. She never got back to Mary Hale, Micah's daughter, but the group understood that somehow Mary was related to Whipple Janders. But what Aunt Lucinda did say was perhaps of greater importance. "So you can see that Whipple comes from some of the finest stock in the islands. For three generations, Whipples have married Janderses, which accounts in part, I suppose, for the way in which their family fortunes have been conserved." Turning directly to Noelani, the beautiful girl who was soon to be married, Lucinda said, "I can think of no one you could have chosen finer than Whipple Janders, and I am extremely happy for you, Noelani. When I look at your marvelous face, I see your great-great-grandfather Micah Hale, the savior of these islands. You have his high forehead, his courage, and his force of character. But your beauty comes from the Whipples.